Sex, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the speculative interdimensional vehicle, Sex in Space. Its mission, to explore new points of view, to seek out fresh opinions, to boldly go where so many have gone before, and still somehow manage to totally miss the point. Subscribe to Sex in Space, wherever quality podcasts are found.
Hi there, and welcome back to Sex in Space. My name's Toshi, and we're thrilled to have you with us today for another podcast episode. Thank you for being here, wherever it is that you're tuning in from. Please don't forget to leave a like, comment, or review. Your feedback and support means the world to us. We have more great Sex in Space content on our YouTube channel, including video versions of our podcast episodes if you'd rather watch and listen at the same time. You can search for us using our handle at sexinspace.com, and you can also find us on Instagram and TikTok under that handle too. For today's episode, I was lucky enough to chat with the wonderful Kate Muir. Kate is a women's health expert, investigative journalist, and documentary maker in the UK. Her book on contraception, Everything You Need to Know About the Pill But We're Too Afraid to Ask, is published this week, April 11th, 2024. And she also produced the recent Davina McCall Pill Revolution documentary. Kate also created two groundbreaking Channel 4 films on the menopause, which ignited a massive conversation among women. Her book, Everything You Need to Know About the Menopause But We're Too Afraid to Ask, is now out in paperback. She is a campaigning speaker and founding member of the Menopause Charity. Let's jump in. Welcome, Kate, and thank you so much for being with us here tonight, today.
Thank you.
So I thought that we could lead off by kind of getting into your background. If you could maybe talk to us, the listeners, about how you got into this area of women's health.
Well, I had a terrible menopause myself, a total car crash. And what I realized is my generation knew nothing about hormones. And I didn't know that menopause was massively about mental health. And, you know, and it can affect your sexual health too. But what I didn't realize is that estrogen and testosterone and progesterone are doing a lot of really important stuff in your brain. And menopause was not about hot flushes. And, you know, I had lots of brain, you know, fog, forgetfulness during, and the minute I got on hormone replacement therapy, the safest kind, my brain came back. And then I thought, right, we have to find out why we've been gaslighted about this, why we haven't been told. So I went from being a kind of patient and an investigative journalist to an activist, really. Mm-hmm. And I did this huge poll for the menopause documentaries I made in the UK. And what we found was that, you know, the mental health symptoms of the menopause were massive. And that was, you know, 84% were sleepless, 73% had brain fog, over 60% had anxiety and depression. And we thought, we've just shut up about this. We are going to change this narrative. So it's been a bit similar tackling the pill as well.
What was it specifically that kicked off that book for you?
Well, again, it was the personal turning into the political. So my daughter Molly was about 21 at the time, and it was the beginning of lockdown. And she came home from university and obviously went to a bedroom in the basement and, like everybody else, seemed really, really depressed. But she was sort of extraordinarily depressed and really couldn't bear to come up and have dinner with us and things like that. And suddenly her pill prescription ran out from Edinburgh because we were back in London. And about a month later, she came into the kitchen full of oomph and bounce and seemed to be back to her previous self. And, you know, lockdown was the same. The bedroom was the same. Our lives were the same. But there was this change. And she and I were talking about it. And we said, what can it be? Why? And then we both realized, oh, my God, you have come off the combined oral contraceptive pill. And it was one of the crappiest pills also. It's the cheapest one they give out in Britain. It right. ain't great. And we both started investigating because I've got my hormonal glasses on from the menopause. And I'm looking at the pill and going, but it's full of the synthetic stuff we don't use anymore in the better hormone replacement therapy. We have body identical copies of our own hormones. Why aren't younger women getting that? Why are they having these mental health problems? And then she started researching and I started researching, and we got the big papers which were out of kind of Scandinavia and places like that, where they'd researched their big data banks to see the levels of depression after the pill. And then Molly showed me her TikTok, and she was looking at all the pill talk on TikTok. And about a third of it was absolute rubbish scientifically. And I was very interested in that. But lots of it was about, again, women being gaslighted, and women who were taking out their the side effects leaflet of the pill and wearing it as a cape or snuggling down under it in the sofa because there were so many side effects. And there were lots of people saying the pill will make you infertile, the pill will do this. And it really made me think, this is where younger women are going to get their information. TikTok is a sort of doctor's surgery without the white coats. This is really dangerous. I didn't know. Molly didn't know. It's our job to investigate this scientifically and culturally. And so I'd done this for the menopause book, so I kind of knew what to do. I had my toolkit. And I also could by then kind of read a science paper, and I'd been taught by a great doctor, you know, what was true, what was not, what numbers to look at, all these things. And so then I went in and tackled the pill. And it's not just a pill. It's contraception. It's the history of the pill. It's sex on the pill. It's trans contraception. It's male contraception. It's the coil. But it's all the same area. So that was very exciting because just lots of the stuff hadn't been properly researched.
It's interesting that TikTok element, because that's something that I've seen too on my feed. And during lockdown, and I guess once you've seen one or two, you watch it for, you know, 30 seconds, and you're engaging with it, and it gives you more. And if you're not out there, you know, fact checking what you're being fed, sometimes, yeah, you know, we'll say things in a way that's quite convincing that you might be inclined to believe them, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's also an anti-birth control going on thing from out of America because of the anti-abortion movement, and they're doing very clever things to try and get women onto natural cycles, which is great if you know what you're doing on the Natural Cycles app. But if you don't and you think it's going to be perfect for you contraception wise you would be wrong. And there's a real kind of political thing going on in TikTok, and I don't know to what extent, you know, the algorithm is feeding me these things, because you can never tell whether it's what you get or what everyone else gets.
Yeah.
But between Molly and I, we got a real picture of what was going on out there, and I just thought somehow we have to start talking about the truth.
Can you talk to us a bit about what some of the misconceptions that you found to be around contraception and the pill from all the research that you've done?
Yeah, the big thing, and again, we wanted to get truth, we wanted to get data. So I did a 4,000 women poll across the UK, and actually there were some non-binary people in there too, which was great. And we asked them about what was going on for them, why they had given up the pill, and a third of women said because of mental health issues, low mood, anxiety or depression. Now, that is not what you read in the textbooks, but this is a diverse sample across Britain, different, you know, economic bands. It's a proper sample of women, and that was the truth they told us. And that the other things were weight gain. They were really, really hating weight gain. So many people were struggling with headaches. And, you know, it was something like 37% were talking about weight gain, 20-something percent talking about headaches, and mental health was this huge issue. Mm-hmm. And people were changing pills again and again, playing pill roulette till they got the right one. And what was clear to me is they didn't understand, which I began to understand as I write the book, that the progestins in the pill, which are synthetic, are either androgenic or estrogenic. So they're sort of masculinizing or feminizing in a tiny wee bit. But if your hormones are just tipping and it tips you over one way, the androgenic element in some of the pills, particularly the earlier pills that have got levonorgestrel or gestrel in them, which is a really, really common pill, they tend to lower your sex drive for some people. And that was really interesting. And we asked women on the pill about their sex drive, and they said 21% said their libido had gone down. Not in the textbooks as a big issue, but a big issue for women and for young women who've gone on the pill to have sex quite often. Okay, they may have gone on to regulate periods and deal with PMDD and, you know, endo or whatever. But, you know, we should be having fun. We should not be suffering and struggling, you know.
Yeah. So what do you think the reason is that those findings are not being reflected in the textbooks?
I think the questions haven't been asked. And I think the pill, you know, the people who wrote the textbooks are quite old now. They are not part of a younger generation. And they're quite, the big fear, I think, is that women get pregnant and that's all they care about, and that they're terrified of teen pregnancy, and they really want women to be sensible and make sure they don't take any risks. And that is the first thing. And looking at any scientific study, the first thing they will report is the risks are low. And then you look into the scientific study yourself and you go, yeah, the risks are low, but 10% of women feel crap on this. And for me, 10% of women is a lot, you know, and the 21% that are finding, you know, their libido is down, they're really important. And, you know, what I did with the libido thing, because I thought, well, I've got an Instagram called Pill Scandal, and actually I've even got a TikTok now called Pill Scandal. But I put it up on my Instagram and I said, hot or not, has your sex drive changed since you've been on hormonal contraception? And oh my God, the answers just poured in. And all these people said, I've been on the pill for 5 years. I broke up with my boyfriend. I wasn't into sex anymore. I came off it. Wham, bam. Thank you, ma'am. I wanted to have sex all the time. And then they said, but that's 5 years of my life I've lost. And often there were people who'd also been depressed on the pill or just flatlined. And I remember, I was suddenly remembering being at university and I was on microgynon, which is this sort of cheap liver and progesterone combined pill, you know, and I was on it for a few years. And I only realized after I left university that I had this enormous creative ovulatory sexual peak every month. I had no sense of that. And it was sort of such a joy to realize that there was this kind of, you know, outbreak of kind of feeling and thinking. And it wasn't just sex, it was brain. And, you know, when Freud used the word libido originally, he meant that sort of zest for life. He didn't just mean, you know, orgasms. You know, he meant something more. And I think we should understand it as something more. And I'm sure you do on this podcast, that's exactly what you're doing here. But a lot of people aren't thinking the way you're thinking.
I think zest for life is such a nice phrase to be using. And actually, one of my questions was, if you were to go back and maybe give advice to your younger self about being on the pill, what kind of message would you want to give to yourself?
I would question the pill. That would be the first thing. Find out what's in the pill and find out about different pills. You know, do I need one with kind of safe body identical estrogen in it, which you can now get? There's three versions with kind of safer estrogen. They're not perfect. But I mean, with what happened to Molly, which is the nearest example to myself, is she gave up the pill and then she went and got the coil, but she also got the smallest coil, which is really great if you haven't had kids. And it puts out the smallest amount of progestin. And oddly enough, it's the same progestin that was in the pill. But somehow, once it was, you know, in the uterus, it wasn't causing any trouble for her. And her heavy periods went down. And, you know, it was uncomfortable and the fitting was uncomfortable. And God, it goes on for like 6 weeks or 2 months afterwards, the cramps, and they don't tell you that. I mean, there is a shit show. But after the shit show, you've got 3 to 5 years of freedom. And I looked into the coil actually after that, and a new paper has come out from Scandinavia, which shows that the smaller coils have less risk of depression. And that's really important for younger women because you're getting a tiny amount of hormones compared to the pill going into your body, but you've got that virtual complete safety from getting pregnant. And everybody is always, particularly on TikTok, actually complaining about the agony of the coil fitting. And if we could get over that a bit and make sure women got proper anesthetics, that someone is properly there to hold their hand, that they know what's happening beforehand, you know, to make it easier, I think that is a really good solution for young women who, you know, don't want to be taking their temperature at 6 a.m. every morning and, you know, checking their mucus on natural cycles, you know.
I think that's exactly the thing. I mean, I got the IUD about a year ago, and the same thing. It's nice not having to worry every single day about taking a pill, you know, you put in. And obviously it does hurt a bit, but, you know, then you've got 5 years of peace.
Really. Yeah. I mean, it's by no means perfect. And there is a small risk of breast cancer, but much smaller with the IUDs. But I do definitely think the smaller the hormones, the better. And one of the interesting things that's happening in some bits of Britain, people are just testing this in the private health area, but women who get terrible PMDD and PMS, if they're on the coil and they're coming up to their period and they're feeling crap, they top up with a little bit of estrogen gel, just a tiny bit, and that lifts them over, you know, through their cycle. Actually, they're probably not getting a period, but at that point where they would be, they get a little lift from that. And it's sort of very interesting to think about using hormones to look after our moods and look after us if we have things like PMDD. And do we need just a lift of, you know, estrogen, progesterone? What do we need a little extra of just before we go in? You know, when people get these, you know, that incredibly bad 2 weeks with PMDD where they feel, you know, almost suicidal, they can't get out of bed, it really crashes for some people. And, you know, topping up the hormones a tiny bit, but you've got a coil to protect the lining of your womb, it's quite clever. But is anyone studying this? Does anyone care? I mean, this is the narrative we've got to begin to change and question. Yeah.
And how many people are you finding are aware of, because obviously, you know, hormones change over, you know, each week and there's different levels. How educated do you feel people are about this?
Interestingly, because of Clue and Flow and Natural Cycles, they're really good apps. And so many women are tracking their cycles. Mm. And I think that makes a huge difference to know when you're coming, when you're going, why your mood is bad, and, you know, and handling your life around that. I think that has been great. So they know that. But what they don't know is what's in the pill, what's in the coil. And we'd in that poll, right, 29% of women couldn't name the pill they were on. So never mind whether it's a combined pill or a progesterone-only pill, you know, and, you know, you still continue to ovulate. 50% of women still continue to ovulate on the progesterone-only pill, but they don't ovulate on the combined pill. But, you know, that could have all sorts of effects on your sex life, depending on who you are. But do we know anything about it? We do not. We're not told. I'm not sure doctors, certainly here, really, really know the difference between the different pills and their effect. They know some very basic stuff, but they don't know the subtleties. And, you know, I really, really worry about that. And one of the things about all the pills, and not so much the IUDs, but the pills, is that they change your free testosterone level. So, you know, your joy of sex level and your joy of thinking as well, all sorts of things testosterone does, goes down, and your sex hormone binding globulin goes up. And so basically the pill, I always think of it as the pill coming in and handcuffing your testosterone and stopping it getting round your body. It's a very easy image to think of. Yeah. And there you are, handcuffed, not in a good way, from having sort of joy of sex. And there's been quite a few studies looking at the kind of response of women to, you know, sexual films, to some porn or whatever, when they are on the pill and when they're not on the pill. And one of the more hilarious studies I found, which was tiny, was the use of the clitoral Doppler ultrasound. And that, and they measured women on the pill and not on the pill. I mean, a tiny number. And the women who were not on the pill, who were on natural cycles, had much better blood flow and throb than the women who were on the pill.
Interesting.
And I mean, it was like a study with about 10 people, 20 people. But, you know, really, really interesting. And the big science, you know, papers and the big people running the Faculty of Sexual Health and Reproduction, they're not going to go and look at a daft wee science paper in the corner that tells you that. But for us, wow, isn't that interesting? What could it mean? Could it be done on a larger scale? You know, I feel that like my book is just beginning to ask the questions that we haven't asked yet. And I'm really aware that in 10 years, you know, it would be a completely different book. No. So it's very much saying, why aren't we looking at this, you know? And the other thing that I noticed is also that we've started to scan women's brains, because we've got the technology to look at brains on the pill, brains off the pill, brains mid-cycle. And we know our brains change throughout our cycle and different bits of them work harder. You know, we're having our ovulation peak, you know, the brain is on it. And we kind of know that. But, you know, the same thing is happening, you know, with our serotonin levels, our kind of happiness hormone levels. Okay. And women who are on the pill have about 10% less serotonin receptor activity going on.
Wow. And that's really
interesting, isn't it? And you know, it's not like us saying, oh, we don't feel so good. It is actually, we can see what is happening in the brain by looking at brain scans.
Wow.
And so we are now being able to acquire our own truth in a way that we had people from outside telling us, well, just get on the pill, don't get pregnant. Of course it won't affect your sex life. And if it does, just swap to another pill. And that was all we got, deserved, you know, and nobody talks with us. Sorry, I'm going on again. But the other thing is that we discovered that 64% of women, certainly in the UK, in our poll, had gone on the pill while they were at school. And I'm thinking, what on earth did I know at school about the pill or what the hormones were? I didn't even know what hormones we had. You know, and we weren't really taught that in science. We're still not taught that properly, you know, in sex education class or whatever. And you just think, but wait a minute. So you're 15-year-old and lots of 15-year-olds are going on the pill for acne because it's really helping with acne. Fantastic. And that's the most important thing in their life at that second. And their friend is on the same pill, so they'll go on that pill. And they don't know maybe that their mood has been flattened for 10 years. And they don't know that, you know, they're going to go on that pill for 20 years and they're increasing by a tiny amount their risk of breast cancer. But what if their mum has breast cancer? You know, you should be thinking about what's in your family. And we're just not. We are giving pills to our children and not thinking about it and not explaining to them, not giving them information for their choice. And I know they are young, but we're not stupid. You know, you can make decisions at 16 that are quite sensible and you're having sex, you know, so you've got to, you know, you've got to make adult decisions and we're not given the knowledge, I think.
And you can't ask questions if you don't know what questions you should be asking.
No.
So again, if you don't have the knowledge, then how do you know to ask, you know, how is this going to affect me?
I mean, I'll tell you what I really didn't. You asked me this 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I had no idea. If you said what hormones are in the pill, I'd think, progesterone and estrogen, and that's wrong. Okay, you look in the pill, it's ethanol estradiol, which is a synthetic hormone, and you know, the progesterone, which is your natural hormone, that's not what's in there. It's progestin, which again is synthetic. And if you look at the shape of those molecules, they are differently shaped. Do you remember in COVID, we were always seeing shapes of molecules on the television with big spiky bits coming out of them. And you go, these spiky bits do different things from the other spiky bits. Literally, it is the same. If you look at a progesterone molecule, our natural hormone, which is sort of lovely, calming hormone in a way. And then you look at the progestin one, it has little other bits, little spiky bits. And you just think, what are they doing? Yeah. And you think, yes, actually, as it turns out, the progestin, the synthetic hormone, can go into your brain and your body and hook onto testosterone receptors and estrogen receptors, as well as progesterone receptors. So it's mucking around with your other hormones. And we don't know to what extent why. And you know, this is the great unstudied story of what's happening to us. So, you know, I just want to know more. And the thing I want to know most about is testosterone and why it's a female hormone. And I really didn't know till about 6 years ago that testosterone was my hormone, that it really, really mattered, that we make a tenth of what men make. But at certain points in your life, like when you're about 18 to 24, It's the biggest hormone, the most bioactive hormone in your body. And you can actually tell that when you're looking at 18 to 24 year old girls rushing around and screaming and being very sexy and excited and full of energy. And, you know, I didn't know that. And then when you look at all the graphs of the hormones during the cycle, you know, there's the peak of estrogen and then there's the progesterone going down. But testosterone's not on that graph of women in any of the main sort of textbooks. But testosterone, you discover, goes steadily along and then makes a little leap at the time of ovulation and then goes steadily along. So it's this lovely, steady hormone in our body. And the idea that it's just about sex is absolute rubbish. It, you know, our brains are filled with testosterone receptors, every bit of our brain. So, you know, our memory, our kind of emotional centers, everything is laced with this. And yet we've been told it comes from the testes, but we don't have any testes. So it's coming from our adrenal glands or wherever else. And, you know, it's the idea that this has been sectioned off as a male hormone and that estrogen has been sectioned off as a female hormone. And in fact, men have estrogen. They have quite a bit of estrogen, and sometimes testosterone turns a bit into estrogen in men's bodies. And men have progesterone too. So all this binary hormone rubbish, it's not true. We are all people who have different amounts of these hormones, but we have the same hormones. And that women have been denied testosterone and understanding of their testosterone, for me, is a massive piece of gender bias in medicine. And, you know, people are still afraid to acknowledge that. And they still think you're going to grow a moustache. And I take testosterone every day because my testosterone was zero when I hit menopause. Some women, you know, it keeps going, but mine didn't. And, you know, it gives me energy. It gives me get up and go. It gives me mental sharpness. I don't forget stuff. I can talk for an hour without notes. And, you know, the estrogen was great, but the testosterone really, really made me feel like I was 40 again, you know, and I'm in my 50s now. But it brought me back to kind of where I was, and I did not grow a moustache because basically I was getting the same hormones at levels as I had when I was 40, and I didn't grow a moustache. And, you know, some people want to grow a moustache, and that's a whole other story with more testosterone. But normal levels and topping up the normal levels, it's really important for your brain. Estrogen and testosterone, really important to protect you against Alzheimer's and dementia. And it's just like, it's such good news, and we're not giving it out. And I'm here to enlighten, you know.
It's news to me.
Yeah, well, we don't learn any of it in school. And I think what is shocking to me, and I don't know what you get in your schools there, but we just get taught the kind of sperm meets egg. You should go to, you know, your local family planning clinic. And there's no explanation of properly the different forms of contraception, the safety elements of them all, how your natural cycles work. I mean, the first thing you should do when you get a bunch of 13 or 12 year olds, or people having periods even younger now, aren't they, is teach them how to look at a natural cycles app and understand themselves. You know, things like that. And, you know, understand that you are a woman and you have three major hormones, and they are testosterone, estrogen and progesterone. And to say otherwise is telling you a lie. And, you know, we have been told this lie forever. And it's really exciting. I have a T-shirt, actually, that has a big pink flower on it, and it says testosterone's not just for boys.
I love it.
Occasionally I wear it to give a talk or something. But, you know, we've got to understand that. And I also think, partly because I did some work with the trans and non-binary community for the book, you know, to understand that we are all more fluid than we know. And at different times of our lives, we are probably more masculine or feminine. And, you know, there's the moment when you're having a baby where obviously you're super feminine. And then there's the moment after menopause when you're a bit more testosterone-y and less loving mummy and out there to change the world, you know. And we are different people with different levels of hormones at different times in our life. And the idea that we are one thing and not the other, and that, you know, I think a lot of people being really interested in being non-binary and questioning where they are is possibly, you know, to do with what their hormones, of course it's to do with what the hormones are doing, but it's a new world and a new way of looking at ourselves. And, you know, it's really interesting.
And can you talk to us a bit about some of your findings from working with the trans and non-binary community in relation to contraception?
The first thing I have to say is I don't know enough about it. And I wrote that chapter not from, well, I mean, in a sense, I spoke to lots of people in the community and a brilliant doctor, but I wrote that chapter from outside. So I'm not saying my expertise is perfect. But what basically happens is that there is no proper research on trans people, and their access to contraception is appalling. And there's this wonderful clinic in London called 56T in Dean Street in Soho in London, and I interviewed a great doctor there who's called Dr. Tara Sushak, who's been doing trans and non-binary contraception for ages. I mean, and one of the first things that we're learning is that, like, you know, basically when people are taking testosterone to become trans men, but yet they've still got, you know, ovaries, and very few people get operations, there is still a serious risk of them getting pregnant, even though periods are disappearing and slowing down. So people have got to be really careful. And quite a lot of the trans men are getting coils, because that is a way of not having to think about it. You don't have to packet of pills by the bedside. It's out of the way. And if you can get over the kind of difficult sort of dysphoria of having the coil fitted, and they're really nice at Dean Street and at these great clinics, then that really, really helps. And then you've got a lot of people who are becoming trans women, and they want to take the contraceptive pill, and they will often get a female friend to get the pill for them and give them it, so that they can start taking some form of estrogen early on. And that estrogen in the contraceptive pill is, of course, the old synthetic kind, and there's a risk of clots once you're in your sort of 30s. And really, they'd be much better if they can going to a proper clinic and getting the natural hormones, which are the body identical ones, which don't have the risk of clots. But again, people are not getting these clinic appointments for years, and people are struggling. And, you know, not everybody's in Dean Street in Soho in London. They're out in the rural, you know, far away and really struggling. So it was so complicated and kind of so unknown. But also, I just think I'm really glad I wrote the chapter anyway, because hopefully people will come to me and tell me more and respond to it. You know, it's almost a big question. And, you know, in a gender diverse community, it's so many individual cases with individual needs. And the other thing, I interviewed a wonderful non-binary person called Dee, and they were telling me, well, sometimes I'm trans mask and sometimes I'm a bit more femme. And so, like, they're a moving target. And deciding what to do about all that at different times in your life is really complicated. And you really need a sympathetic clinician to help if you need help. So I'm just aware of, you know, contraception, bad enough if you're just going in and getting, you know, the pill or the coil, but oh my god, if you've got other complexities, it's rotten. It's just really difficult.
Yeah, so much hard. Is there something that you've that's been quite memorable for you that you've learned from putting together this work, something that's really stayed with you?
Yeah, my big thing, my big shocker, is the history chapter, actually. And the, you know, I was thinking, oh, we're being gaslit now. Wow, were we gaslit and exploited then? And you also realize women disappear from the story very early. Okay, so the history is, you know, the pill was invented by Dr. John Rock and Dr. Gregory Pincus in America. It turns out the money to finance the pill came from a woman called, who was a sort of suffragette, actually, called Catherine Dexter McCormick, who married a man who went crazy, and he was sort of kept, you know, locked up somewhere on her estate, unfortunately. But she had access to all his money, and she spent $2 million of it on the research for the very first pill, which is worth like $23 million now. And, you know, it was a bit dodgy. This is a dodgy story, but it's really interesting that we're talking female finance to get this done. The other appalling thing, everything about this story is appalling, is that the first people to test the pill were inmates in a mental asylum in Massachusetts, and they gave it to a bunch of women and a bunch of men. And the men got really, and nobody understood what they were taking. They weren't really told, you know, were they signing off if they were not fully compass mentors? I don't think so. Anyway, the men complained, said their balls were shrinking and they were feeling funny and they were all coming off this pill. The women just sort of seemed to stay silent and put up with it. And these were really high doses, right? So we don't know what happened to those women, but they didn't seem to be ovulating or whatever. Then these guys can't test it on anyone in America legitimately because it's never been tested before. So they take it to Puerto Rico, which is sort of being treated almost as a colony of America. And they test it on 256 women. The doses are 10 times what we have in the pill now.
Wow.
Really dangerous in terms of clots and strokes. Three women die. They don't investigate why they die. They just take them out of the trial. Then a quarter of the women say we've got dizziness, headaches, nausea. And again, they disappear from the trial too because they can't tolerate the pill. Wow. And those are often signs leading up to a clot, you know, dizziness, not, you know, I mean, interesting. So they disappear too. So we're left with the survivors. And guess what? None of them, or apart from I think one of them who didn't behave properly, but basically 99% of them do not get pregnant. Rubber stamped by the, you know, Food and Drug Administration. We send it through. It's a tiny study in which people died. And those women in Puerto Rico, you know, they died for our sex lives. You know, they were given, and God knows how many died of strokes and things afterwards. We don't really know. They're not a big follow through. And, you know, that the pill was causing clots and strokes, but it took a long time and women reporting and reporting for people to understand that these doses were too high and that there were these risks. And I'm just like, why didn't we know that? Why, you know, and I'm just aware that, you know, all that matters is our fertility or not fertility. Who cares what happens to our bodies or our minds or our risks? And we have to get out of that mindset. And I don't think we've got out of that mindset yet.
What things can we do to try and change this narrative and try and advocate for ourselves in this space?
Wow. Well, I think when you're going to your doctor, you ask, you get really informed by good sources online. And, you know, you ask questions and you don't think I have to put up with this. I mean, I also think, you know, there is a real kind of rising up of women, and I would say they are embracing green sex, which is kind of tracking their natural cycles and using condoms or, you know, abstaining or whatever. And that is fine if you're a well-organized person that's not hungover or taking some drugs in the morning and your temperature hasn't changed. But, it, you know, I imagine my student self being unable to use natural cycles in any sensible way. But, you know, you can do that. And a lot of women are also just taking the morning after pill when things go wrong. But and more, you know, there's huge numbers of sexually transmitted diseases increasing. And certainly in Britain, I don't know about you, but we've got the highest abortion rate we've ever had because people are unhappy. And I think the thing is to now try and make yourself happy, ask questions, find out about these small calls, demand things, you know, but it's a real struggle. There's one other thing I wanted to talk about, which is the vaginal biome, which I know we all want to hear about. Well, you know how we're always talking now about the microbiome in our stomachs and, you know, it's got all these good and bad bacteria. And I didn't realize till I really got into it in this book that we have this vaginal biome, vaginal microbiome.
Okay.
And it's filled with lactobacillus bacteria, which you get in yogurt and kefir and things like that. So it's similar to that. So there's this really happy bacteria down there, all busying around, all different. There's about four or five different strains of it, all partying down there. And if it's all happy, you don't get UTIs. You know, you lubricate well during sex. You know, your skin remains nice and plump in your vulva. It's all happy. When you get the pill, and particularly, it doesn't really matter which, but some are worse than others. Quite often that gives you a dry vagina and a dry vulva because it seems to be the progestin affects the lactobacillus in that area. And one or two people find that going on, say, the progesterone-only pill gives them bacterial vaginosis, you know, it smells different, or they get vulvodynia, which is sort of sex problems and pain on penetration, all these things. And often young women wouldn't realize it, but they need topical vaginal estrogen, which could be a cream or a little pessary. And that brings back the estrogen, helps the lactobacillus thrive in the vaginal biome. And it all makes it happier down there. And the other thing that really helps is probiotics and taking them orally. And if you take the strains that are in your vagina already, you know, they're called things like Lactobacillus rhamnosus and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of them. And if you take them, that can also bring back the pH of your vaginome. But of course, we just need to spend more time kind of loving our vulvas, knowing what's in there, looking at them, mm-hmm. smelling them, feeling how juicy they are, all these things that we're all a bit, I'm sure on this podcast you're not embarrassed about any of this, but so many women are, and they're just going, I don't know what's going on down there. It just, mm-hmm. I just put a bit of lube on, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And actually, lube is not going to solve your problem. You know, you need something that will really penetrate mm-hmm. and help you. And I think, you know, let's talk about the vaginal bio. You could do a whole podcast on the party going on down there.
Yeah.
Really, really important.
I think, I mean, something that we've noticed on the podcast or just in general with our work that we do is even something so basic as having the right language to talk about our anatomy, vulva and vagina. A lot of people don't actually know, you know, the difference. Yeah. And so, you know, and then trying to talk about the vaginal biome, it's so hard to kind of get from here and then get even further. So, again,
but we should just understand it because everybody is totally talking about what's going on in their stomachs and, you know, the gluten, the, you know, and the glucose levels in the biome. And yet, guess what? Yet again, we're only talking about the thing that matters to men and women. But the vaginal biome is incredibly important to our general happiness. And again, this sort of takes me into my menopause work is that, you know, basically, when estrogen disappears at menopause, your vagina dries up, your vulva dries up. It all gets very dry. You do not want to ride a bike. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's really uncomfortable and papery. And basically, your skin is losing collagen. And you look at a menopausal woman's face, if they're not taking HRT, and they tend to lose collagen in their face and they're getting bags under their eyes and skin is drying and they're using tons of moisturizer and they're spending all this money on Chanel. We need Chanel for our vulvas too. And actually the Chanel is hormones and it's really safe, doesn't cause any risk of breast cancer because it's a tiny amount, really safe vaginal cream, vaginal estrogen, topical, rub it in every couple of days and you are ready to go. And all those women in menopause who 50% of them are saying their sex lives are not as good as they were or if at all, you know, it's really worth knowing about that. It makes a huge difference.
If you know, if someone was to go to the doctor with issues, is this something that the doctor would know how to address?
I think, again, we have to bring it up. I think sometimes the doctor, if you go and say, I've got a dry vulva and you're menopausal, they would probably know that. And they would say dry vagina because that's the only bit that matters to men, obviously. But for us, you know, a dry clitoris is quite important too, so, but we're not, you know what I mean, you know, happy labia, you know, it's just quite funny that we only see it as a dry vagina. But yeah, I think for younger women this is not known, and I didn't know it till I wrote the book. And I was thinking, I've got my menopause glasses on, what happens when we're taking hormones away from younger women and flattening their own natural hormones? And then once I thought of that, I went and looked for the science papers, and of course the science papers show that there's a percentage of young women, maybe 20%, who might get drier vaginas and vulvas, and it's really, really important to look after that for your own pleasure. You know, you're not necessarily having to be having penetrative sex, but you want to make sure all of that feels great for yourself. You know, it's not, you know. So I think that's, yeah. It's really important. It's really important. We have a big vaginal, but maybe I'll put some stuff about the vaginal microbiome on TikTok. I'm learning how to do TikTok. A bit old for TikTok, but that's where the audience is.
TikTok is great. And I think that's where a lot of conversations can happen and are happening. And actually, I wanted to ask you, I saw when you posted, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about a survey done about the male contraceptive pill. And how,
oh, hilarious.
And it was funny because the day before I had a conversation with a couple of friends of mine, one of them is a guy, and he said, would you trust a male partner to be taking it? And I was like, I actually hadn't considered that, but maybe not. And obviously the results from the survey were interesting too. So can you talk to us a bit about...
Yeah. So in that survey, which I think was about a few thousand women, done by Superdrug, one of our big pharmacies here, and 63% of women said they wouldn't trust a man who said they were taking male contraception. And then what was really bad was 32% of men said they wouldn't trust themselves to take male contraception. You just think... Oh, for God's sake, just pull up your pants and get on with it. I mean, literally. And obviously that was a small bias survey. But then because I put it on TikTok, I got like 100 and something replies of people having this conversation. And it was quite clear that couples, committed couples, this question is a different question for committed couples. If you love that person, you trust them, and you've seen your, you know, girlfriend or whoever on synthetic hormones, and she's been depressed and unhappy and not enjoying her sex life, she comes off them, and you can do something about that, and you can take the burden. Oh my God, you will. And guess what? The burden will not be so bad for you, because the stuff they're putting into the new male contraception is better than the stuff we are getting and have gotten the pill. The pill really hasn't advanced much in 60 years, but the kind of progestin in the male shoulder gel, which is progestin and testosterone, which you rub in every morning, very few side effects, seems to be great, keeps their testosterone up while keeping their sperm down. And that's got a new progestin in it called nesterone. And it's got really, really good qualities in terms of risk and everything else, but it's barely being used for women. But that's what the men are getting in the shoulder gel trial, which is going really well around the world. It's great, but it's been done by academics, because guess what? You know, big pharma don't want to pay for this kind of thing, because they could already hand out the pill in buckets.
So
couples is one thing, but I think people on, you know, on Tinder ain't going to trust someone who says, oh, of course I'm on the pill. Although men trust women saying that. But I'm thinking, you should be using a condom anyway, guys.
I sort of wanted to end by asking your goals with this book. What is like the main thing that you're sort of wanting to achieve, or that you can take away from reading your book?
Exactly what we're doing here, which is shouting about it aloud and asking questions. Because, I mean, I think this book is basically a door I've opened to a kind of Pandora's box of God knows what's going on around contraception. But what I've got in there is, I've taken it very seriously. I've got the science papers and I've got the footnotes. And yes, it's filled with people's stories, but it also tells you the truth. And if you want to follow down the line of this science paper on polycystic ovarian syndrome and, you know, taking the combined pill, you will find, you know, more detail on that. So it's partly a resource, but it's partly let's tell women the scientific truth about what's going on with hormones in their bodies. And let's give them the best chance to ask the best questions and make the best decisions for themselves. And I just really want to have a big shout about this, because that's what's happened with menopause in Britain and increasingly across the world. We have unleashed an army of menopause warriors, and I hope we will unleash an army of questioning pill poppers, or whatever you want to call it. But people who want better contraception, who are not getting what they need right now.
Then is there anything else that you would like, that I haven't asked you, that you'd like to really share with our listeners?
No, I just think, you know, contact me, actually. I'd like to hear stories from people. And I'm on Pill Scandal. You can message me. And I think I will learn more as I go along once this goes out there. And, you know, it doesn't stop with a book, because I continue to talk and give speeches and debate with people and fight medical institutions. So the more information and conversation that's happening, the kind of more I learn, and, you know, people around me learn. So I think, you know, I'm just welcoming a kind of, you know, big debate.
Have you, when you've had debates with people, have you found people have really shifted their mindset around contraception at all? Have you noticed it kind of in front of you, someone changing their viewpoint?
Often people are just really shocked about what they don't know. That's the stage we're at the moment. It's not, and they're going, oh my God, does that do that? And there's also been one or two people I've said here, you know, they've said, oh, I'm feeling crap, or my sex life is this, or, you know, my vagina is that. And I'll go, why don't you just go and look at this medical paper and take it to your doctor? So I'm not a doctor, but I know where the sources are. And that has been a great joy to be able to say to people, you can do something about this problem. And the first thing may not work, but the second thing might. And they've gone away and come back and gone, yes. You know, and that, you know, giving people their sex lives back. That's worthwhile, isn't it?
Wanting to empower people to have agency for themselves and have positive impact in their life in that way.
So that's
fantastic.
But the stuff you're doing there, and I hope there are many other people like you around the world, you know, this is what we need to do. Have this conversation. Start shouting.
Have conversations and then start shouting and, you know, scream from the rooftops, really. Thank you so much, Kate, for joining us today on the Sex and Space podcast. To all our listeners who are here with us today and will be listening to this podcast, you can find Kate on two separate channels, at Pill Scandal and at Menno Scandal. That's on Instagram, Twitter /X, and TikTok as well. Is that the same?
Yes, I only do Pill on TikTok at the moment, Pill Scandal on TikTok.
Wonderful. And this podcast, when it will be released, will be in the same week that Kate's book is coming out. So if you're listening, the book will be out in 2 days on the day of this podcast.
You can get it everywhere on audiobook, I think, even if it's not in your local bookshop, because it may not have spread around the world by then. But it's definitely on, and I read the audiobook. So
amazing. Thank you so much, Kate. It's been lovely to have you and to chat with you.
I've loved it. Thank you.
We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. Again, if you want to find more of Kate, check her out at Pill Scandal on Instagram, Twitter, or TikTok. To learn more about her work with menopause, you can find her at Menno Scandal. Before we sign off, we wanted to remind you to check out our two books that we have available, How to Talk with Your Kids About Porn and The Organ Education Forgot. These are both available as downloadable PDFs or in print, and you can head over to sexandspace.com to grab your copy. If you do, not only will you be educating yourself about a very important subject, but you'll also be supporting us in all the work that we do. If you'd like to support us in other ways, we'd love for you to buy some merch, which is also available on our website, and we have both mugs and t-shirts. As always, thank you so much for listening and being on this journey with us. Until next time, safe travels, and see you on the next episode.